I'm here with Frans de Waal, who is one of the world's foremost researchers on chimpanzees, bonobos, and does a lot of research and public discourse about empathy. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Can you maybe tell us a little bit about who you are and some of your background?
I'm a biologist by training. I'm from the Netherlands originally, but I live and work in the U.S. already 30 years. At the moment, I work at Emory University and at the Yerkes Primate Center, where we have lots of monkeys and lots of chimpanzees. I work mostly with the chimpanzees.
And you also work with bonobos?
I also work with bonobos, yeah. We do both, yeah. But the bonobos are not here. The bonobos we work with is either at zoos or at a sanctuary in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So we don't have the bonobos here at the Primate Center.
Right. So what? You grew up in the Netherlands. What prompted you to move to the U.S.?
Oh, I could get a job in the U.S. And at that time, there were no jobs in the Netherlands. So it was a pretty easy choice, I think.
Right. So you've written some books some time ago in the past talking about the concepts of empathy relating and the sort of the aggressive environment with the chimpanzee. More recently, you've started talking a lot about bonobos and a lot of the public conversation about empathy and aggression in the chimpanzee environment is a little bit distorted, and we need to be thinking more about the bonobo style. Maybe do you want to talk a little bit about that and what you think is being done incorrectly today?
Yeah, so I'm interested in the issue of empathy. That actually started with my studies on chimpanzees, where I found that after fights, they approach the individual who has lost the fight and who is usually distressed. They approach them and they kiss them and embrace them. And I heard, for example, from developmental psychologists who work on children, that the way they test empathy in children is to instruct a family member to cry and then see what children do, and children approach them and touch them and stroke them. And I said, well, if that's how you test empathy, then that's something that I see regularly in my animals. And so that's how I started to make a connection between the behavior of the chimpanzees and expressions of empathy. And then later when I studied bonobos, I noticed that they are even more empathic than chimpanzees and very gentle and sensitive. And much less violent than chimpanzees. And so I got interested in comparing the species as well. And it's an interesting comparison because bonobos and chimps are exactly equally close to us. And people tend to favor chimpanzees when they make comparisons with humans, but there's absolutely no reason. And bonobos are just as important.
And my understanding is that both are equally genetically related to humans. There's not too much difference.
Yeah, there's a recently, like a year ago, a paper came out. It's called The Bonobo Genome Compared to Chimpanzees and Humans. And what they found is that genetically, bonobos and chimpanzees are exactly equally close to us, and like 98.5% identical DNA.
But the reality is, while this serves as a nice model of left-right, so we have the chimpanzees representing the right and the bonobos representing the left, they're just two of a lot of species that were around over the period of time, and for some reason those two have survived. Is that correct?
Yeah, they are not. They are not on our lineage directly in the sense that you would want to compare us with Australopithecus or with Ardipithecus, which were bipedal apes basically, which are in our lineage. Bonobos and chimps are a bit more distant. They're more like 6 million years ago that the split with them occurred, but it's the closest that we have alive. Everything else, like the Neanderthals are dead, the Australopithecinae are dead. So if you're looking for live relatives, bonobos and chimps are the ones you want to look at.
And how are the groups doing relative to each other? Are the chimpanzees, are they a stronger group than the bonobos? Are they both surviving more or less equally? I mean, I know that they're in a difficult zone because they're in war zones.
Yeah, the chimpanzees, they live on a larger geography. So the bonobos only live in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in a fairly small area, about the size of the UK, whereas the chimpanzees live on a much larger area. And so there are automatically more chimpanzees, but we are pessimistic about all the apes at the moment. So the bonobos are not doing it so well, but I think all the apes are in trouble.
Is there a possibility that we'll lose them?
Yeah, there's a genuine possibility is that by the year 2050, all the apes may have disappeared, and maybe there may be some remnant populations in some reserves. So, for example, in the larger Congo, there are the Salongas, which is a large reserve where the bonobos live. But even there, there's bushmeat hunting and poaching going on. And so even in the reserves, I'm not 100% sure we will keep the apes.
Hmm. And have you spent a lot of time over in the Congo?
No, I do most of my work in captivity. I have students and postdocs who work in the field. But our focus is really on primates in captivity because I want to see the details of their behavior. And I also have a desire to manipulate their behavior, so to do experiments where we set up a situation where they can share food or they can help each other and see under which circumstances are they willing to do that. And that sort of research is in the field almost impossible. And so I have a different focus than the field workers.
And so how do you respond when people criticize and say, well, you know, he's not over there actually living with them, so he doesn't really understand them that well?
Well, that's a sort of strange criticism because if you want to understand the intelligence of children, let's say, you want to say the young ones of our species, are they smart? You're not going to observe them in a schoolyard or in the street. You're going to bring them into a room and put them behind a desk and ask them questions or give them a computer game or set up whatever test you want to set up. But that's how you test intelligence and cognition and psychological tendencies in children. And that's the way we do it with the primates. And so, yes, you can do field work. It's wonderful, and it's absolutely essential that we have people who do that so that we know how they live in the wild. But if you want to get at, let's say, psychological features in any detail, you need to do additional things. And so I think it is complementary in the sense that the field workers are needed, the captive workers are needed, the lab approaches and controlled experiments are needed. And then you piece all these different pieces together and you get some sort of image of what a bonobo or a chimpanzee is. And it's very few people who do that. For humans, we have probably 1 million or maybe 2 million psychologists who are testing humans every day. And if you go to a primate meeting and you ask how many people work on chimpanzees and bonobos, well, you may end up with 50, 60. That's right. About the numbers we're talking about, you know. So we have a lot of work to do for those species compared to what we do on humans.
Yeah, I mean, it's hugely important work that you're doing.
Mm.
And so your basic goal is to apply psychology and psychology testing to chimpanzees and bonobos. And do you have bonobos as well? And you're doing that in captivity?
No, in the bonobos we do mostly at the moment observations at a sanctuary where we are looking at expressions of empathy among bonobos. And one of our goals at this point is at that sanctuary they have a lot of orphans because these are victims of the bushmeat trade and the young bonobos are confiscated on the markets and then brought to the sanctuary and raised by humans, so they are orphans. And we're comparing those orphans with mother-reared bonobos, because we also have those, to see what good mother-rearing does. And as in humans, it's extremely important. If you look at the orphanages, the Romanian orphanages, there's a lot of studies of these human orphans, how emotionally disturbed they are and how they have trouble with empathy and with conflict resolution and all those things. And so we are comparing that in the bonobos to see what the effect is of being an orphan versus being mother-reared.
Hmm. Do you want to maybe talk about some of your research into IQ and where you think IQ testing is going?
IQ testing, well, we usually don't call it IQ testing, but we test basic cognitive skills in, let's say, tool use or can you learn from others, which is called observational learning or social learning. Do you understand reciprocity? Do you understand cooperation? So that's the sort of tests that we do on chimpanzees, on elephants, on bonobos. People do it on children, of course, quite a bit. And the thing with that kind of research is that you really need to design tests that are suitable to the species. So, for example, imitation studies very often, where they look, for example, if apes ape, that's the verb that we use for them. The imitation studies very often used human models. So a human demonstrates to an ape how to open a box, let's say. Then you give the box to the ape and you see if the ape does the same thing with it. Now, it turns out the apes rarely do the same thing as the human does. And they may bang the box or try to open it in their own way, but they don't particularly imitate what the human does. And people have concluded in the past that that means that the apes don't have the capacity for imitation. But that's
Do the apes yawn when one another yawns?
Yeah, that's other tests that we do in yawn contagion, but that's more like an empathy test that we do. But the thing is that what I was going to explain is that if you do the tests where they need to imitate a human experimenter and they fail, people have then concluded that that means that they don't have a capacity to imitate. Mm. But actually, you should test them with other chimpanzees because they pay a lot more attention to chimpanzees than to humans. And that's what we have done. And if you do chimp-to-chimp imitation tests, they are actually very good at it. And so the problem with all these intelligence tests is that sometimes minor details, seems like minor details in the methodology, they determine what you get out of it, because we need to adapt these tests to what suits the species.
And so I saw, I guess it was an extract from your book in the Wall Street Journal, which was pretty amazing about how some of these tests are being redesigned for elephants, for example.
Yeah, so elephants, people would put, let's say, food outside the cage area of the elephant and then give the elephant long sticks. And they would assume that the elephant, of course, would pick up the stick with its trunk and then bring the food in, like a chimpanzee would do that any time with his hands. But the elephants did nothing with the sticks. And the conclusion then was that the elephants don't know how to use tools, until some other investigators, they did a very different test with elephants where they hung food very high above the enclosure and they gave the elephants boxes. And very quickly, the elephants would move the boxes under the food and then stand on top of it. So that's also tool use and then getting to the food. And so the elephants were perfectly capable of understanding tool use, but they were just not very eager to pick up a stick with their trunk. And the reason is probably that their trunk is their smelling organ, and as soon as they pick up a stick, they shut that off, and so they don't want to do that. And so you have to work with the elephant, so to speak, to get a tool use.
From some of the looking that I've been doing at IQ testing, and it's a kind of a controversial area, but IQ testing in different races around the world, we look at IQ levels here in the US of measured below 70 or below is considered mentally retarded. However, there are racial groups that have measured IQs lower than that, and they're not. And so clearly, I think there's some real problems with how this testing is being done, and it needs to be really worked on.
Yeah, of course, I'm not an acute tester in humans, but the general assumption is that IQ is quite sensitive to cultural environments, to educational environments, and so you would need to control for all of that before you can make any statements about any racial group. And so in general, we're quite skeptical about what IQ tests does, and that's not the sort of test that we give to primates. So primates, we test very specific capacities. We don't do some sort of general intelligence test. We don't really have that.
One of the other interesting things is in the world of autism, which is an area I'm pretty interested in, is that there's some research suggesting that, in fact, autism may be at the very extreme end of intelligence, which can lead to developmental delays. And so it may actually be that some of these people that are unable to speak, in fact, have ultra-high intelligence, and it's limiting their ability to develop emotionally as a normal person.
Yeah, that's all possible. I think in autism, we have it's called a spectrum disorder because we have a whole set of different problems that are sort of pulled together.
Right.
People are now starting to make finer distinctions, which is a good thing, I think. But we sort of lumped it all together and said that's autism, but there's a whole bunch of different things involved, I think.
Yeah, like group the whole group together by one label that's based around their weakness, and rather than splitting them up into different groups that are totally different. But anyway, yes, I agree very much. One of the interesting things about autism, I would imagine you're familiar with Simon Baron Cohen's systematizing empathizing theory. And that talks about the systematizing drive in autism and the drive to organize things. If this turns out to be correct, and this is obviously still only a theory and hasn't been proven yet, although it is, I think Simon Baron Cohen is considered one of the leading autism researchers. If that is correct, and the systematizing drive is in fact one of the key measures for intelligence and breakthrough, have you ever thought about, or has this ever been done, to measure the systematizing drive in animals?
No, we don't really do that. We are just at the point that we're measuring empathy, which is, of course, very interesting, because Simon Baron Cohen, initially, like 10 years ago, I suppose, he believed that autism was a deficit in theory of mind.
Right.
Theory of mind being that I understand what you know, and that I understand your intentions and knowledge from seeing you behave in particular ways, and I can understand what you have seen and what you have learned, and so on. So theory of mind is a quite a high level cognitive feat. And I'm always skeptical about theory of mind, because even the word theory doesn't fit well. I think we gather a lot of knowledge about others through bodily sensations and bodily identifications with others, which are not theoretical at all. But anyway, Simon got more skeptical about the theory of mind thing, because, of course, we can detect autism quite a bit earlier than the age at which theory of mind emerges. And so he started thinking that it's maybe a more basic problem than theory of mind, and that brought him to empathy. And in my discussions about empathy in animals, we get the same sort of process going, because if I say that chimpanzees have theory of mind, people would object to it. But if I say they have empathy, they think, oh, that's a more basic feature. That's that you're sensitive to the emotions of others, that you adopt the emotions of others. And people can understand that chimpanzees and many other mammals may have that capacity. Your average dog has that capacity to be sensitive to your emotions. And so we're now sort of looking at these much more basic features of where do things go wrong in autism, so to speak. Is it sort of a cognitive process like theory of mind, or is it more an emotional process like empathy? And I think we're coming down on the emotional side at this point.
Right. I mean, that's interesting. Do you have anything more to say on that point?
I'm not an expert on autism, but very often I hear people speak about autism, because we have the Autism Center here at Emory, the Marcus Center, which is headed by Ami Klin. And so we have a lot of autism research going on campus. And my sort of superficial impression is that there are two potential problems with autism. One is that there's an emotional problem of connecting, let's say, emotionally with others, which would be which you could call an empathy deficit or an empathy problem. But it's also possible that emotional problem barely exists, but that autists have trouble reading faces and looking at faces and looking at the eyes of others. And so they try to avoid, especially in extreme cases, the children with autism, they try to avoid faces and not look at them at all. And of course, if you don't look very carefully at faces, you're going to miss an enormous amount of information about the emotions and about the situations of others. And so it's more an attentional problem, if that's true. Has more to do with attention and motivation than with emotions and emotional capacities. And I always find that fascinating, because people sometimes mention the one and other times mention the other, but it's almost as if there are two theories out there about what the problem of autism is.
Yeah, I think Simon Baron Cohen is correct after having done a lot of research. And
what is his take on this? Is that it is an emotional deficit?
It's the systematizing empathizing drive. It's built in that way, and that in the mild form, it's highly useful. It means you can work in Silicon Valley, or you can be Albert Einstein, and in the severe form, you don't develop and you don't move forward emotionally.
You mean that there's actually a competition going on? Is that right? You're either systematizing, which then excludes paying attention to emotions, I suppose, or you're empathizing, which then excludes. So is there a competition between those two sort of drives that you call?
I don't know if it's necessarily competition. My suspicion is it's more that the brain is just designed with a stronger systematizing drive that also includes a couple of other features. So a very strong detail orientation and then a lower empathizing drive. Because one of the things in building a society is you'll have a group of people that are all strong empathizers. They'll get together and they'll say, we're going to put this is our corrupt system and this is how it works. And so you need then at some level a group of stronger systematizers to come along and say, no, corrupt people, you all are sitting there in empathy with your system. It's not okay. We want a better system that is fair and cleaner, and we're going to fight with you until this gets put in place. And So effectively what Simon Baron Cohen suggests is that this is something that has developed from indigenous people over time, and so some groups of people are stronger systematizers and some groups of people are stronger empathizers.
And what about sex differences? Because, for example, empathy is very much developed in females. This is true for many mammalian species. So we've tested chimpanzees, there's rat studies, mouse studies. Females are just stronger on average on empathy than males are. And of course, in autism, there's also quite a bit of a sex difference.
Obviously, there's more men on the autism spectrum than there are women. And it also varies by race. Some races have a lot more autism than others do.
And why would that be?
It looks like it's evolutionary evolvement. That's kind of a long conversation that's probably better offline.
Okay, yeah, well, I don't know anything about that anyway.
So to your knowledge, then, there's been no research on autism or this systematizing drive in animals?
Well, there have been some claims. But, you know, if you raise a chimpanzee in isolation or a bonobo in isolation, so as an orphan or in a human family, you get all sorts of abnormalities. So that doesn't mean that the individual has any intrinsic problems. It's just that the environment is not the normal environment. And so the claims have been made for some human-raised individuals. In the wild or in large captive groupings of bonobos and chimpanzees, I've never heard of people talking about autistic traits. That doesn't mean that they don't occur, because, of course, we're dealing with small numbers. And for example, I work with two groups of chimpanzees. Each group has about 15 individuals. Well, if the prevalence of autism was anything close to humans, it would be like 1%, isn't it? 1 or 2%.
Right.
So the chances of finding one is low, but imagine that there's a lower prevalence, and that in chimpanzees maybe it's 1 in 1,000 individuals who has this condition. Then what are my chances of finding it? You know, very low.
Mm. Have you come across other psychiatric conditions in animals, such as schizophrenia or bipolar or other sorts of things?
Well, we did one time together with a colleague of mine who's a specialist in psychopathy, we once did a sort of personality test on the chimpanzees. But you know, that test by itself is already problematic, because what we do is we ask animal caretakers to rate the personalities of individuals. So you get already a human filter that is put on top of it, which is the caretakers. But in that research, we found the psychopathy dimension. It doesn't mean that we had necessarily psychopaths in the group, but the same dimension came out of that research that you find in humans. And so it is very well possible that that kind of condition exists in chimpanzees.
So you found psychopathy. Does that mean there was sociopathy as well?
I think that's almost the same, isn't it?
I think the psychopathy is the extreme version and the psychopathy is the less extreme.
Yeah, but we didn't find necessarily psychopaths. What we found is the psychopathy dimension, as the personality researchers call it, which may not be the same as that we find a psychopath, you know?
That's interesting. And so, Do you see when you observe the animals? Do you notice traits that, because you're quite comfortable labeling animals in human terms, have you noticed other traits that you would attribute in those sorts of lines to humans among any of these psychiatric dimensions, or is that the only test that's been done?
Yeah, I don't usually think in those dimensions, but of course, personality differences are very prominent in chimpanzees and in bonobos. Is that anyone who actually has two dogs or two cats knows that there are big personality differences in those animals. And I would say that in chimpanzees and bonobos, they're even bigger and more similar to that in humans. So you find individuals who are very empathic and altruistic. You find individuals who are very selfish and only competitive. You find individuals who are withdrawn and try to stay out of trouble all the time, and other individuals who are very extrovert and jump into everything they can. And so all these personality differences that we know in human society, you find in the primates. And they're very consistent in it. And sometimes, of course, when an individual changes position, you may have an Let's say an adolescent male who at some point becomes the alpha male when he's a bit older. And yes, he may completely change his behavior, so to speak, from being shy and withdrawn. He may become very domineering and so on. So we do see changes, but there's many individuals that I've known over many years, some individuals I've known for 25 years or 30 years, who just like in humans, they just keep that personality that they have, you know?
So, in your work with the chimps, and I mean, I guess all of them, do you become friends with them? Because if you know them for 25 to 30 years, that's a long time.
Yeah, you become friends with them, and they recognize you, and I recognize them. There's individuals from the old zoo colony where I used to work in Arnhem who still recognize me and greet me when I stop by. And so, yeah, they become friends. You don't take them home. They're not friends that you invite to your home address. But other than that, yes, they are friends.
And are they ever dangerous towards you, or do they know you and trust you and?
Well, potentially a chimpanzee or a bonobo is always dangerous. It's a bit like working with tigers, because chimpanzees are far stronger than humans. And so some people who have these large cats, they may trust them up to a point, but you can never trust them 100%. And that same problem we have, of course, with great apes, is that you always have to be careful, because if there's going to be a physical confrontation, you're going to be the loser.
Yeah, right. Have you ever had any problems with them?
No, I never had that problem, but I don't necessarily go in with them, you know, so that's not our goal. Our goal is to do observations and test them on certain cognitive capacities. The goal, there's never the goal to go in with them. Some people do that. People who do, for example, language research on the apes, they often raise them in their home, and they but that's a very tricky situation that sometimes get out of control, and accidents have happened with that, as you may be aware.
And so, what I mean, your big topic that you're well known for is empathy and the connection with the bonobos. And I mean, I hadn't heard about this much until I started hearing about it from you in the media. Why do you think that this isn't being discussed as much before, and we just hear the violent chimpanzee versions of how animal life is?
Well, there's a long tradition in anthropology to look at human history and human evolution as a sequence of battles that we have won. So we wiped out these people, we wiped out those people, we wiped out the Neanderthals, and that's how our race has advanced. And so it's a very violent sort of scenario of our species. And when it was found that chimpanzees kill each other in the wild between territories, where males enter territories of others and sometimes kill others, sort of all of this clicked together as one story, and people would say our ancestors were already like that because chimpanzees are like that and we are like that. And so it's a very violent scenario of human evolution. When the bonobo was discovered and we learned more about bonobos, the anthropologists really didn't know what to do with them. They were horrified in a way, because all of a sudden there was this very peaceful, hippie-like primate who was exactly equally close to us as the chimpanzee, and what can we do with them? Female dominated, moreover, so that was really problematic for them. And the general attitude in anthropology was to marginalize them and to say, well, bonobos are actually sort of offshoot. They are irrelevant to human evolution. They're sort of deviation from the chimpanzee lineage, even though there's no reason to say that. It's very well possible that the last common ancestor was bonobo-like instead of chimpanzee-like. We really don't know, but that's the story they went with. And so anthropologists have never been happy with the bonobo. Now, there's a lot of other people who feel it's very important that we consider the bonobo, and I'm included in that, is that I feel since they're equally genetically close to us as the chimpanzee, and since we don't know what the last common ancestor looked like, we need to take them very seriously. So that's my attitude.
And in your book, something that I thought was hilarious, and I suspect maybe rather true, is that scientists will come up with a grand theory at some point in their career and then spend the rest of their career defending it.
Yeah, that was a comment that I made in response to Jerry Coyne, who's a fellow biologist, because I'm sort of reacting a little bit to the neo-atheists, as you may have noticed in the book, and he's one of them. And he was contrasting atheists, who he considers rational, with the believers and religious people, who he considers irrational. And so he said, we rational people, like in science, we are always waiting for the counter arguments to our theories. We're always waiting to hear what's wrong with our theories, because we want to have the correct theories. And I was reacting to that, because I don't know any scientists who want to hear how wrong he is. Most scientists want to hear how right they are. And most scientists, they don't even want to listen if you tell them that they're wrong. So let's say you have a big theory and I tell you, but do you consider the following evidence that is not in line with your theory? Then you would probably sort of shut me off and not want to talk with me anymore, because I'm telling you things that you don't want to hear.
Yeah.
That's how most scientists are. Most scientists are pretty vain and have thought of something brilliant in their younger years, and then for the rest of their life they keep working on that.
One suspicion that I've had, and this is probably extremely politically incorrect to say, but I'm going to say it anyway, is I have a suspicion that some of the strong proponents of the chimpanzee model may be mildly on the autism spectrum themselves, and it's a way to demonstrate what we don't see in a more feminized society today.
Oh, I've never thought about that. I've heard many comparisons, people saying chimpanzees are like Republicans and bonobos are like Democrats, and people have made all these kind of comparisons, but this one is new to me. But yeah, people, it is true, of course, that people look for confirmative evidence for their thinking. So if the bonobo fits their thinking, like you find, for example, feminist groups or the gay community, they love bonobos because bonobos sort of fit their line of thinking. And then you have other people who love chimpanzees because it fits their thinking.
Right. And that's I got to admit, when I first came across your work, I was like, oh man, he's just a hippie that's just pushing this hippie agenda, and like I don't like what he's got to say. But as I've dug a lot deeper into this, and also contrasting it with Jonathan Haidt's work at NYU, talking about the moral biases of left and right, I believe you're right, and I believe they're right, and that we have both, and that both are important.
Yeah, I'm actually not. You may think that I have a preference. I think human men have a lot in common with chimpanzee males, because we are very political, power oriented, coalition formation. We can be quite violent, we men. So I think the chimpanzee is absolutely relevant to the human story. But at the same time, I want to consider the bonobo. The bonobo is sexier and more empathic, and I think those are very important features of the human species. And so I usually like to consider both and think we have a little bit of both. I'm not necessarily thinking that we should only consider the bonobo. I think both species are very relevant to us.
And that's the impression I got from one of your first books was on more of the violence of the chimpanzees, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My first book was Chimpanzee Politics. And there's a lot of parallels that you can draw between what chimpanzee males do with each other and what human males do with each other.
So why do you think, I mean, I guess I don't understand, because to me, what you're talking about is very rational and makes sense. And I guess then this brings in this whole area of religion, and it gives atheists a way to discount religion and all the, because religion obviously brings problems, but it brings benefits too. And I guess it gives atheists a way to push back against religion.
What gives them a chance to push back against religion?
Just their
rationality, or
the rationality in saying that, you know, this is what we're descended from, this base of logic and aggression, and you know, this all this stuff around empathy we don't need to worry about. And when you come along with the bonobos, you're effectively validating emotions and empathy in a way that is maybe uncomfortable for them. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Yeah, that's especially uncomfortable for men, of course. You know, when the first studies on empathy were done, they were done by female scientists. And one of them, Carolyn Zahn Wachsler, once told me that when she started studying empathy, which is like 30 years ago, in children, she could barely give serious scientific talks about it because people didn't take it seriously. They said that's maybe a topic for women's magazines. It's not really a topic for scientific journals. They classified it with telepathy and astrology. You know, they considered it basically a feminine topic, empathy. Now at the moment, of course, everything has changed. There's a lot of serious neuroscience going on now on empathy in humans, and it's taken very seriously as a very important capacity. But you know, I think men have always been uncomfortable with emotions, and have sort of pushed that to the side and thinking that rationality is the more important part, you know, that we need to look at. But all of that is at the moment changing, and I've always felt that empathy was an important characteristic. And I'm a man, and so I can say that, because if a woman says that, then they immediately will classify it like, oh, she's saying that because she's a woman. So I'm sort of in the middle of all this, sort of caught in the middle.
What are some of the reactions that you get to your work?
Well, I think the resistance to using the word empathy for animals has largely disappeared. So when I started doing this, this is now like in the mid-90s, I started talking about sympathy in animals. People were resisting it. And I think partly because they had a very cognitive interpretation of empathy. They thought empathy was the same as theory of mind, means that I can understand your situation and so on. They had a very cognitive view. And of course, if that's your view, then your average dog, so to speak, has no empathy. But if your view is, as I kept defending, I kept telling, well, you need to think at a lower level. You need to think at the emotional level, like understanding the emotions of others, feeling the emotions of others, being affected by the distress of others or the happiness of others, for that matter. All these things fall under empathy. And if you take that broad definition of being an emotional affected by others, then people could see, well, then of course my dog has empathy too, if that's your definition. And I think that's where we now are, is that a lot of people can understand that all the mammals probably have some level of empathy going on, and that the more complex forms where I understand your perspective, those are maybe only limited to some large-brained animals like elephants and apes and humans. So they're probably much more limited, but the general feature is found in many animals.
Have you found, I mean, you've spent a lot of time with both chimpanzees and bonobos. Have you found that you feel more connected with the bonobos?
No, as I said, I'm actually very attracted to chimpanzees also, and I feel male chimpanzees, I have a lot in common with male chimpanzees. And
you're the first person to ever tell me that.
I understand the way they think, and it's also because I've been looking at chimpanzees for 35 years, and so even though I've never been part of their social system, at some point you know exactly what they're going to do under what kind of circumstances. And that's true for many field workers also, I think. Many field workers, they live day in, day out with their animals in the forest, and at some point they start thinking like these animals. At some point they know exactly what they're going to do under certain circumstances. And so I have that feeling with chimpanzees. And with bonobos, I always have, since it's a female-dominated society, for me as a male, it's a bit harder to understand, I think. I have had some female students who work with bonobos, and I think they find it easier to understand the bonobo than I do. It's at a, what I mean is not at the scientific level, but at some sort of basic human level, you know.
And so, does this, is it actually easier for women to work with the bonobos like than the chimpanzees?
Well, I think the violence of chimpanzees is a big turn off for many women, I would think, and I think it's a big turn off for many men also, because chimpanzees, most of the time they're peaceful, but these few times that they get violent, they really go berserk, you know, and so this frightens us, and I think it frightens women probably even more.
That's really interesting. So are there more female bonobo researchers than male?
Or in primatology in general, I think we have a lot of women. For the bonobos, I'm not sure that the ratio is different for bonobos than for other species. We have just, in our field of primatology, it's either 50-50 or maybe even 60% of the scientists are female. There's a lot of women there. Yeah.
So where do you see all of this research? I mean, you, as we've discussed on this call, it's evolved a lot over the last 35 years in the course of your career. Where do you see it going over the next 35 years? What do you think are going to be the big areas?
Well, if we can keep them in the wild, which we hope, then there will, of course, field work will keep going. And then in captivity, the big trend of the last 10, 15 years is that the work has gotten a lot more cognitive. So we go through these waves in primatology. There was a wave of field work, which was from the 60s to the 90s, where field work was absolutely dominant in our field, and everyone wanted to work with primates in the field. And then people got interested in cognitive problems, like what do they understand about cooperation? What do they understand about tool use? And those problems require that you test them in captivity in certain laboratory settings. And so that became dominant. But I think now we're probably moving in the direction of understanding emotions a bit better. And that will require close observation under both conditions. I think field workers can work on that topic, and they do already. They, for example, they collect urine, and mostly urine and fecal measures, where you can get at the cortisol levels, which is the stress levels of individuals. And in captivity, we can do tests that test certain emotional reactions. And so I think that's probably the direction in which we're moving, more to the emotions than the cognition now at this point.
Do you think we understand cognition much better?
Well, there's a lot to do, but cognition is easier to get at than emotions. Emotions, of course, the experience, the emotions that experienced, we will never get at. And even between humans, you can tell me what you feel under certain circumstances, but still, it's going to be very hard for me to feel the same thing that you feel. That's almost impossible to explain to somebody else. And with the animals, of course, we can measure emotions, and we can define emotional reactions like love and hate and jealousy. We can define these things, but what the animals actually feel, that remains inaccessible to us.
And obviously a hot topic in the whole field of empathy is mirror neurons, out of the research from Parma in Italy. What are your thoughts on where that's going and mirror neurons in humans?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of hype on that. Is that everything under the sun is now explained by mirror neurons, from empathy to imitation. I think mirror neurons are an important part of the story, but I cannot imagine that a single cell can take a lot of complex decisions. And so in a single cell, to have the recording of both your own motor actions and somebody else's motor actions is awfully interesting. And I think it's a very exciting finding, and I hope that Ruggellati at some point gets the Nobel Prize for it, because I think it's incredibly important, because it brought the discussion now on empathy down to discussions about perception of motor actions, which I think is very important. But there must be more going on than just those mirror neurons. But people often forget, when people try to apply mirror neuron thinking to humans, is that the evidence is still far stronger for monkeys than it is for humans, because in monkeys, of course, we do the single cell recording. The physiology can be done in monkeys, and in humans it can barely be done. And so the evidence is much stronger for monkeys than for humans. And for humans, there's a lot of extrapolation going on, where we look at certain areas of the brain and we say that's where the mirror neurons must be. We assume that they are there. and then we see if they are activated or not. But that's a very indirect method compared to what we do with the monkey studies.
There is a group out in California that is doing work on people's heads when they're open, aren't they?
Iacoboni is the only one who's from the Parma lab and works at UCLA. He's the only one who has done some single cell recordings in humans, in human patients who allowed him to do that. And so there is now finally some direct physiological evidence. So I'm not saying that mirror neurons in humans are fictive. I'm not saying that they don't exist. But the evidence that we have is really much more for monkeys than for humans. And it's interesting for me also because if mirror neurons are so important for empathy and imitation, and they were first discovered in monkey brains, that of course tells us also something about the continuities between human empathy and imitation and that of other primates.
Hmm. I mean, it would seem logical that we are going to have mirror neurons in humans, and we're going to figure it out eventually, but we need proof.
Yeah, I think there is now some limited proof from that first study by Iacoboni, and we're going to get more proofs. And people will do a lot of imaging studies where they sort of assume things to be there. Yeah.
We need better fMRI machines so that we can see into people's brains more easily.
Yeah, I'm not sure we will be getting down to that same level where you can see single neurons being activated. I'm not sure that the imaging machines can do that for you.
Mm. Okay, well, we've covered a lot. Is there anything that you would like to talk about which we haven't covered?
No, I think we covered an enormous amount of stuff. So this seems fine to me.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for doing the interview.
You're welcome.